and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. I remind you, you can always write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us on the web at taylor-report.com. Today we're going to be speaking to a professor of anthropology in Montreal, and Maximilian Forte, and he's written a very interesting piece in Monthly Review. You can get it at mrzine.com. And it's it couldn't be more timely because our members of parliament have been advised by our NATO representative on what our position should be. And Mr. Forte is critical of though many people who have been commenting and providing a kind of ideological assistance to those who are conducting this war. And later in the show, about the halfway point, we will be talking to our old friend Sandra Rusch, who was part of the flotilla effort and went through much travail. And she's going to be speaking in Toronto at the end of the week, and we'll talk about that. But we're going to get her story of her experiences. But now we are joined by Professor Maximilian Forte. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Thanks very much, Phil.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. It seems to me you've written a number of really interesting articles, but the most recent being that I saw was in Monthly Review, mrzine.com, and it's titled Libya, Lather, Rinse, Repeat, Syria, Liberal Imperialism, and the Refusal to Learn. I was just saying, and by the way, by way of introduction, it's really important to be talking about this now, because not only did your article appear at this time, but we also have a member of Canada's military who was part of the NATO brass, apparently had a meeting with some members of parliament to, according to Toronto Star, to warn them about what we must do and must not do.
Yeah.
So it's a good time for you to be writing this. Now, you target a couple of individuals, and I want to get you to talk about them, because many people are helping to shape policy, and some of them are celebrated writers, such as Mr. Robert Fisk. I forget where he publishes. And then we have always seemed to be hearing from Amnesty. Could you talk about why you chose to address what these two gentlemen have said recently?
All right. Well, in fact, in both cases, Robert Fisk and Salil Shetty, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, I focused on those two merely because they were two of the most recent calls for in Fisk's case, writing for The Independent, he basically comes out and asks for direct Western intervention in Syria, and I mean military intervention. He's very explicit about that. Mm-hmm. He even gives military advice indicating where RAF bases are located and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. and how they could conduct a mission against Syria. Salil Shetty of Amnesty International, writing almost at the same time, this is just in the last few days, much more indirect, doesn't really say what he wants. He actually says something ought to be done, but he doesn't really make it clear. But between the lines of what I read in his article on the Amnesty International website and the constant reference to Libya, makes it sound like he pretty well intends for some sort of direct intervention in Syria, which is also, by the way, a really serious deviation from Amnesty International's norms in previous years. Mm-hmm. It's now becoming you can't say combatant, but a partisan in these conflicts.
Mm-hmm. In one sense, they've returned to a moment in history which it was remarked on, and I'm really interested in your opinion about this, that many years back when the first Bush number one attacked Iraq, He told the American people that he had been moved to do this when his wife was watching an alleged Kuwaiti nurse, and sitting next to her was someone from Amnesty, which gave, you might say, gravitas, I guess, to the testimony. And the woman said that the Iraqi soldiers had taken, she was a nurse, and that they had taken children out of incubators and threw them on the floor so that they could take the the incubators to Iraq. Many people, of course, were shocked later to learn that that was all a fraud. I mean, that the woman testifying was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. But you point out in your article that the subject of incubators has come up again. And shouldn't we be saying to people like Amnesty and, of course, to Robert Fisk, listen, you got it wrong, didn't you? I mean, years ago you got this wrong. Why would we listen now? And I think that's one of your themes. We seem to repeat very often almost the same kind of scenarios.
That's right. Well, I mean, there's two sides to that. On the one hand, yes, the incubator baby story has been revived in the case of Syria. And in the case of Libya, speaking metaphorically, perhaps, you could say many, many incubator baby stories have been invented. Everything from the invention of African mercenaries to Viagra-fueled mass rape to the use of anti-aircraft guns against protesters, and on it goes, none of which have been substantiated, all of which have been denied, none of which have been documented by any serious or independent organization, and so forth. So there is that side. But on the other hand, I wouldn't want to dispute, like in the case of Syria, that there has been extremely heavy-handed repression against protesters. But this raises another issue about what is the role of the West in such conflicts and civil conflicts and so forth. Are we to always inject ourselves as the saviors, as the people who are going to be writing other people's histories and instructing them on the proper forms of governance, which we seem to often lack at home? So there's a way of sort of airbrushing our own self-image, writing ourselves as if we are the destiny of all of mankind. These are some of the attitudes, this kind of renewed civilizing mission that, especially as an anthropologist, I find really disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll tell our listeners again, this is Maximilian Forte. He's published a number of articles, but most recent being mrzine.com. And by the way, you have also your own site, openanthropology.org. And you're one of the founders of Anthropologists for Justice and Peace. One of your focuses is on this phenomenon, which seems to me very evident, which is humanitarian imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing everything. To me, it's a sort of an echo, but it's always for the very best of reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, we brought Christianity, for example. That was a big help. And then now we're going to bring some more stuff.
That's right. No, that's right. There is a very long history to this, and I'm not surprised that there are many people who are unfamiliar with that history. There's a tendency not just to forget the past, but as I've discovered recently, there's a tendency, at least among a few individuals, I don't know how representative they are, to not just forget the past, but to also forget the present. And I have no idea what kind of mental condition describes that, or how you would what would the terminology be that psychologists would use to describe such a condition. In a sense that now the question is, how could Syrians be any worse off under the yoke of foreign oppression? Are they in any way comparable? And I'm thinking, but, you know, the war in Iraq is actually ongoing. So how could we dare to forget the present, where we've seen violence on such a massive scale? And it's violence that's been occurring in many ways for two decades. I mean, the carnage and the bludgeoning that Iraq has suffered as a nation. under the yoke of foreign oppression. Mm-hmm. Whether it's 1.5 million people who died under UN-imposed sanctions, or, according to some estimates, between 500,000 and 1 million civilians who've died as a result of the U.S. invasion and occupation, or the 4 million Iraqis that have been displaced. You know, and this is in a population of 24 million. It's unthinkable. It's almost on a genocidal scale.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so, you know, I just on that point, a week ago on this program, we interviewed former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, and he pointed out something that in Syria, one of the economic issues they've had to deal with is the refugees from Iraq.
Yes.
And, you know, when we have reporters here, the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, they're telling us about the problems. Why don't they mention that one of the challenges of trying to run a stable government there is it's hundreds of thousands, I think somewhere around 250,000, maybe 500,000 refugees.
Yeah, no, you're right. And in this sense, the mainstream media, anyway, have been extremely disappointing. And some of the most disappointing exchanges I've had have been with Neil MacDonald of the CBC, who's been to Libya and who's reporting, in that case, plainly echoed everything the rebels told him. Mm-hmm. And any of their own human rights abuses, their revenge killings, execution of prisoners, lynching of the sub-Saharan Africans and so forth, none of that appears in his reports. And I asked them, how is that possible? How come even groups which supported intervention in Libya, such as Human Rights Watch, have come out and documented these things, and you don't even mention it at all in passing?
By the way, I'm interested. Did he answer you?
He did answer me, and it was a very unproductive exchange because it reduced to, you know, had I ever been to Libya and so forth. And I said, you know, at this, if we continue along this line, at some point you're going to be asking me, have I ever tasted the flesh of another man in my mouth?
Yeah.
No, because it always comes down to that. What do you know about war? Have you been in war? Have you ever crawled through a trench filled with blood and guts and so forth? As if this is what's necessary in order to understand some of the issues that I raised.
By the way, this is, to me, is rather central. I mean, certainly I sat up straight as I was reading you. And by the way, it's a very eloquent piece. I really hope everybody will go to the site and read it. But you're speaking of something which I feel I'm noticing a lot, which is a sort of an assumption. For example, in the case of Mr. Fisk, he becomes very arch and kind of like Colonel Blimp or something. He, let's do something. I mean, you have the planes.
Yeah.
Blow up those tanks. I mean, what amazing gall.
Yeah, he is not, you know, he's often been celebrated in the past anyway. I think the number of people doing so is diminishing, but celebrated as a kind of radical, courageous journalist. And I think in the days immediately after 9/11, it seemed that way. He was saying things that were very unpopular. And, you know, I don't know if this is a rumor or a fact, so I want to be careful, but it's alleged that that actor, Malkovich.
Yes.
What's his Malkovich?
Yes, John Malkovich said he wanted to shoot him.
That's right.
That's actually when I first got introduced to the subject. I was listening to KPFA Berkeley, and I were talking to a very arch Englishman, and I was found him very irritating. And then suddenly they said, and now Malkovich wants to shoot you. Then I thought, well, I guess he's okay.
So, you know, he had that kind of aura, but when one examines it, his statements with a little bit more attention, you realize that it's not such a great deviation from the sort of mainstream narrative that you have coming out of places such as the U.S. State Department or NATO headquarters, for that matter. There are some minor quibbles, I suppose, but it's not that much of a difference. And his enemies, let's put it this way, are all the same enemies as Hillary Clinton's. So it's not really not very inspiring that there are those who'd consider him to be a radical speaker of truth, and this is what you get from him.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly been, it has been, it's dangerous when we consider that people are trying to grasp suddenly, they're confronted with a lot of alarming information, and then they read, they have to do something, and then someone with a reputation tells them. And going back to Amnesty, you make a very important point in your article. You say that these human rights organizations seem to neglect or often neglect the United Nations resolution or whatever it is on human rights, I got to get the language right, but it includes social and economic rights,
mm-hmm.
which they never invoke. But I mean, obviously, in the case of Libya and probably in Syria, that would be a highly relevant matter to be looking at.
That's right.
Are people fed? Do they have schools? You know, that kind of thing.
No, that's right. This is something that for a very long time has been neglected, the question of social and economic rights as fundamental to defining human rights. When the United States State Department issues its annual report, I believe it's an annual report, about nations with a poor human rights record, it always focuses on civil liberties, freedom of speech, right to organize, and so forth. It never focuses on social and economic rights. And at one time during the Reagan administration, the Secretary of State for a long time was Jean Kirkpatrick. And at the UN, her response to those who were pressing for greater recognition of social and economic rights was to refer to them as a letter to Santa Claus. So the only realistic...
A lot of people think the U.S. is Santa Claus, so it might be relevant to...
That's right. So, and this is what I was summarizing very briefly as saying, you know, the U.S. values the right to tweet, but not the right to eat.
Yeah, no, that's very... Yeah. Yes, indeed. I mean, we're told, and you must be interested as an anthropologist in this, we're being told, oh, you see, through the magic of new communications, all these things have happened.
Yeah.
Actually, there were revolts before there were tweeters.
That's right.
Revolutions before, you know, email.
Yeah.
It seems kind of odd. We're always being flattered. Isn't that part of your thesis? Is that we're talking about ourselves.
Yeah.
And to ourselves. It's all self-referential.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I mean, this is a theme that's emerging, has been emerging at least since 2009, I think it really came into prominence with the Iran election protests in June of 2009. There was this huge rush in especially the U.S. media to declare what was going on a Twitter revolution. And it's one of those things that I wrote about back at that time. It's something that I investigated very closely. I mean, most of the participants in Twitter writing about Iran were not Iranians. They were American. They were writing in English and so forth. Yes. It was an American Twitter revolution about Iran.
By the way, you're interested in the phenomenon of soft imperialism and such. You must have been struck by this new phenomenon we have now where everybody has to hold up their sign, no matter where they are in the world, in English.
That's right.
So that CNN can take a shot of that.
Exactly.
And you say, I wonder how many of those people actually speak English.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, it also indicates, you know, this is one of the things that disturbs me a bit because on the one hand, it indicates who their intended audience is meant to be. Once you've given that away, my question is, what is it that you want from that audience? I've been having some interesting discussions by email with Syrians who are not willing to get any more concrete than saying, we need more pressure. But pressure in what form? Pressure is a pretty ambiguous word. It can be pretty open-ended and so forth. So I'm worried about that. And I'm also worried about people who, how can I put it, have bought into this sort of mythology that we are there to do good and we're going to be helping them and there are not going to be any strings attached. You know, this. I'm wondering, where do they get this from?
Yeah. By the way, since most of us would, if we were being told that ourselves, we would say, I doubt that.
That's right.
I tell you, you know, we all understand about strings in our own society.
Exactly. So this kind of spread of uncritical enthusiasm for Western saviors is a really disturbing phenomenon. I mean, mm-hmm. it involves amnesia, selective attention, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You also make a very nice point. By the way, I should ask you if you're these articles you refer to, if someone goes to openanthropology.org, can they find the material you've been writing about?
They can. There's a menu tab that says reports, mm-hmm. and that breaks it down into different categories.
Because you go into the issue of indigenous people,
yeah.
And you have a caveat when someone says, well, you know, we got to call on countries that don't have an interest, for example, India, Brazil. They wouldn't do anything bad.
Mm.
You had some comments on that, particularly Brazil.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see the Secretary General of Amnesty making these comments about Brazil and India as free and open democracies that harbor no neocolonialist ambitions and so forth. First of all, that's ignoring Brazil's geopolitical dominance within South America itself. We'll leave that aside. When we come to the position, the situation of indigenous peoples within Brazil, Amnesty's own reports do not paint a very happy picture, let alone the reports from Survival International, which has devoted a considerable amount of resources and attention over many years to documenting the plight of indigenous Brazilians. So that kind of gloss was bizarre. India's engaged in a brutal counterinsurgency war within its borders.
Mm-hmm.
Shetty goes much further. He starts invoking the voices of the leadership of Saudi Arabia as a credible authority on human rights when it comes to discussions
right.
of Syria. And it's unbelievable to read this. You know, this is from a human rights organization.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, by the way, one of the things I've asked myself, and you must know the answer, is that when we talk about human rights and it's invoked and people take their hats off and say, we just heard from this organization, it's usually based in London or New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know of one in Paris, maybe. But I never see an address like Dar es Salaam or South Africa, where someone would say, the Human Rights Organization of South Africa says, you know, here's the situation.
That's right.
We don't have that at all.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation. I mean, you're very right. It seems to be a kind of discourse that's monopolized in one part of the world. And one part of the world seeks to define the standards for the rest.
And they're not a mendicant organization, are they? I mean, they do ask for money from somebody who has a lot.
Right, right.
we're talking to Professor Forte, Maximilian Forte in Montreal. And I have to ask you, we've had this moment here in Britain, very ugly episode in the streets of London, actually across other parts of Britain. And it just at that moment, the prime minister of the country, after saying some disparaging things about the demonstrators, he warned Africa that they have to look out for the colonialists of the 21st century, who are China. He didn't say plural. I mean, look out for China. And he's warning. He says, you know, because after all, we were colonies. We understand the dangers. What do you make? That must be a lot of grist for your mill.
Yeah, no, but David Cameron is something else. I mean, you couldn't have scripted a better character for a Hollywood film. He seems to be someone who's come out of this movie titled In the Loop, which I believe was also a television series in the UK. He's not only, how can I put it, condemning China or criticizing China, but, you know, he's speaking as if Britain has not been involved in Iraq, has not been involved in is not involved in Afghanistan, is not involved in Libya. I don't know that China's involved in any of those wars in any kind of way, except perhaps coming in and scooping up the benefits in terms of whatever contracts it can get. I can't make a prediction about China in the future.
Mm-hmm. He at least represents an empire when he says that.
That's right. Well, it's still a little.
It might have lost its right hand, but it seems to feel like it's still there.
That's right. No, that's right. And anything to distract attention also from the obvious troubles at home, which he then tries to minimize as being, moral breakdown, improper values, and so forth. It's not dissent of any sort. Let's not get into, as he says, phony human rights issues and so on.
Unless we're talking about some other country.
Yeah, that's right.
You quote the Manchester Police Department, some spokesperson, we want to make it absolutely clear there's been no spark that has led to this.
Oh, yes.
So the family of the dead man probably would be the first to jump to his side and agree.
It's an absolutely astounding statement. I mean, what the authorities try to give us as a theory of social action or social change and so forth is just absolutely astounding. There was no spark that led to the riots. There's no cause. There's no sense of injustice. Of course, this is also aided by the mass media, which... And actually, Julian Assange is the one who noted this and spoke about it quite loudly, that there was not a single interview in the days of those riots with any of those rioters. And he pointed out that from BBC to Al Jazeera, and in his words, all we got is garbage. That is not a single interview with any of these people. So you can superimpose whatever you want. You can say that, they're doing it purely out of greed, out of arrogance, out of entitlement, to use that kind of American terminology and so forth. Mm-hmm. I do have relatives who live in various parts of Greater London, and they reported to me that in their neighborhoods, anyway, all the supermarkets were looted. Mm-hmm. These people were stealing food. We were led to believe by the mainstream media that they were stealing, high-end items, plasma televisions, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
If people had started calling it food riots, then it gives it a very different sort of image. But those are things that we don't hear about in the mainstream media.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, that seems to play into a notion which is common in the upper crust of our society, which is to... attribute all activity by the lower orders to envy of them.
That's right.
So it would occur to them that the only thing you must want is a suit like the one I've got.
Exactly. Exactly. No, that's
rather
a good
than
point.
Food. I don't know how they... Well, actually, you're raising that question, why we're so able, and certainly our mass media, to keep us talking on and self-deceiving ourselves instead of just looking at the facts or asking someone who would know. I got to put this question to you. When we get reports from Libya and Syria, we're continually being told, well, the opposition says, the opposition.
Yeah.
Well, I'm all very interested in what the opposition says, but nobody ever tells me what the government says and what in any form that I can, properly digest it in terms of information. Why would they want to present me with the views of the opposition? I don't know the opposition.
Right.
I don't know the government.
Yes.
I don't live there.
That's right.
No,
not only that. I mean, you have to wonder how much the opposition knows of itself since they've turned to killing each other in recent days and weeks. There isn't that much trust on their side either. But this is going on. I mean, at this very moment as we speak, you could turn to... a stream of newspaper articles about the recent rebel claims to have made, serious advances, to have taken towns or parts of cities and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the media reports, the less you know, all of them indicate that the information comes from rebel spokesmen, and that they've not independently confirmed the truth of their statements. Mm-hmm. Some articles don't even mention that. Some leave the question of confirmation and verification to the very end of the article. And some, you know, there was an LA Times article that I read last night about some of these rebel advances. Their reporter, who was reporting on these rebel advances, was reporting from Cairo. You know, somebody needs to tell them that Cairo is not in Libya.
Quite a ways away, actually.
So you get this quite a lot. They've been given, and some have remarked on this, and not really in the mainstream media, but that the rebels have really been given one endless series of generous passes. Mm-hmm. When Libyan government spokesmen are quoted, they're quoted as if they were jokers and clowns. I mean, something to laugh at. They'll choose some of their most outlandish statements, and there have been a few, mm-hmm. and make a meal of it.
Mm-hmm.
Things that are more serious, that are very abundantly documented, such as this recent NATO bombing of a civilian community that resulted in upwards of 85 deaths of civilians.
Yes.
I mean, journalists were taken there, body parts were being filmed, all of these things, and you hardly saw any mention of that, again, on the evening news or anything else.
Yeah.
Hardly at all.
Yes, as far as I know, NATO, as a matter of fact, being very stubborn on that one, they're saying that they have no information about that.
That's right.
And our zealous media is not going to find out. Last part of this, I'm going to make, and tell our listeners this. We're speaking to Maximilian C. Forte. He is the author of a number of really important pieces, but particularly we're talking today about the item on the Amnesty International and Robert Fisk. But isn't the use of this human rights language becoming is sort of an enabling process? When someone says, oh, they're killing their own people, we have to do something. Actually, in formal legal international terms, that's war. And you're supposed to go to your people and say, I have to go to war because this is we have a foreign enemy.
Yeah.
Right. But because we have this new bug, human rights, the one I'm looking for is the responsibility to protect.
Exactly.
The public can't even debate that because we have to rush off and attack somebody.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and this has been the case in the United States where the complaint is that the Obama administration consulted with everyone except the U.S. Congress, which he's supposed to. So he's in violation of the War Powers Resolution, but I don't know what this is amounting to. Nothing seems to be done about that.
Well, he's doing a good deed, you see.
Of course. But, you know, I mean, one has to think, it's of course, there's a history to it that precedes George W. Bush. But George W. Bush really maximized this sort of discourse about human rights, the constant refrain that Saddam Hussein gassed. And the key phrase here is his own people.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is using this now, his own people. I would hate for me to be identified as belonging to Stephen Harper.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this kind of patronizing, even condescending way of speaking about citizens. Mm-hmm. But and again, with Afghanistan, if you were to suspend disbelief, you would think that the entire invasion and occupation in Afghanistan was carried out just so that little girls could go to school.
Oh, exactly.
And especially if you listen to Laura Bush, this is her constant message. But you know, as I said, I can't go through it, not even if we had hours. But what's very interesting is that I would recommend to some of your listeners to look up the speeches that Adolf Hitler gave, justifying the need to invade Czechoslovakia, and notice the constant emphasis on peace, humanitarianism, the need to protect innocent civilians who are being unjustly targeted by a government that doesn't respect their rights and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So all sorts of regimes throughout history.
Mussolini was going to save the Ethiopians from slavery, right?
Absolutely. All sorts of regimes have used this human rights or humanitarian discourse to justify all kinds of atrocities.
It sounds like we need a grown-up population. That's going to be hard work.
It is. And I don't think social media is helping. This is the thing.
You know, I agree. And, well, your work has been wonderful. And people can go to openanthropology.org. And we've been speaking with Professor Maximilian Forte, who's Associate Professor in Anthropology at Concordia University. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
It's been a great pleasure for me, too, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that was Professor Forte. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And we're going to take a little break, and we will come back, and we will speak to Sandra Rusch.